from the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalists. I'm Josh Kranzberg, in for Jason McClure. On today's show, we're taking a break from our regular coverage of international news for an installment of our periodic series of interviews with distinguished journalists and writers. We're joined today by Asma Khalid, a reporter for WBUR, the NPR affiliate in Boston. Previously, she covered the 2016 election for NPR. Now she's part of a new team called Bostonomics, which focuses on business, technology, innovation, and the economy in Boston. Asma Khalid, welcome to Global Journalists. It's a pleasure having you here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
First, a little bit of background. You are a self-described Hoosier, growing up in a mostly Democratic county, but a small, mostly white, conservative town in Indiana. How did you get interested in journalism?
Gosh, you know, I feel like it's probably in some ways not such an unusual story because I realized from a recent girlfriend that she had a similar example, and that is that I read a biography of Nellie Bly. I don't know if you're familiar with Nellie Bly, but she's this, you know, sort of amazing journalist who traveled the world in a limited amount of time, did some really great exposés. I read her biography when I was probably 7 years old.
Wow.
And a little, you know, miniature picture book biography, and resolved that that's what I would like to do. You know, that's sort of what I wanted to do. And I think from there on out, I was just sort of committed to wanting to do that and went on to work at the high school paper, went on to major in journalism.
Did you know from that age that you wanted to do radio, TV, newspaper, or was it just, I just want to be in journalism?
I think it was much more, I want to be in journalism. I actually went to the Indiana University School of Journalism, and at that point, there were kind of two tracks. One was broadcast, and the other was print, and I did print. I thought I would likely work at a newspaper, but when I graduated, newspapers were already starting to see some major changes.
What was it about journalism that drew you in? I mean, obviously, you read the biography, but what was it about that hooked you?
I think one was just the opportunity for adventure. I mean, she seemed to have this extraordinary life. And then I think the other is the ability to create change, right? So for viewers who maybe aren't familiar with Nellie Bly, I mean, she was this woman who maybe this you could argue is not entirely ethical, but faked the idea of being mentally ill, right? To go in and look at how mental institutions were treating people. But this brought about change. And I think the ability that you could see for a journalist to actually affect change to me was really powerful even at a young age.
I think we're all pretty thankful you decided to go on that path. We'll get to the election in a bit, but I want to talk about the job before the election. You were at WBUR and actually started a month before the Boston Marathon bombings. You were actually at the marathon shortly before the incident happened. Talk to me about how that affected you being so new to the city. Yeah. Just talk to me about that experience.
Sure. So my husband and I had moved to Boston in mid-March. So it was just about a month before the marathon bombings. And we were new to the city. Patriots Day, as it's called in Boston, is actually a holiday, and you are off from work. And so all of sort of the friends and acquaintances I'd had who spent time in Boston ever said, you have to go to the marathon. That's a classic thing to do. So we went. We were on Newbury Street, which is about a block or two away from Boylston, which is where the attack happened. And we were actually trying to get to the finish line. But if you've ever been to the Boston Marathon, there's just throngs of people. Of course. And unless you show up really early, sometimes it's actually hard to get to the finish line. And we couldn't get through the pack of people. So long story short, we ended up just heading home. I was hungry to get some lunch. And then the bombings happened. And, you know, as a new journalist, it was just it was surreal, right? Like I had an inclination that something was horribly wrong. Biked into work real quick because the marathon day, a lot of roads are closed. Biking was kind of the easiest thing to do. My editor immediately sent me out to Mass General Hospital, where I spent hours and hours and hours. Mass General Hospital is one of the facilities that received a number of the victims that day.
What was that like being so relatively new to the city and having this gigantic story? I don't want to sound like it benefited, but like it fell into your lap. It fell into your and your colleagues' laps. Just talk to me about that.
So, you know, in some ways as a journalist, I felt it was trial by fire, right? Like I didn't know Boston. I didn't know the people. I didn't even know the roads. I mean, this sounds sort of naive probably to any Bostonian, but I had no clue how to get to Mass General Hospital from my office. I remember Googling it. The roads, a number of roads were closed. I couldn't figure out how to even get to Mass General, which is, you know, for anyone who spent time in Boston, it's sort of an easily identifiable institution. Everyone
landmark,
knows where it is.
Yeah.
And so I think that was one part of it, was it was a moment to really sort of sink or swim as a journalist. I think that the emotionally challenging thing about it was many of us in the newsroom just worked immensely long hours, right? We were working around the clock. You would work until, God, it's like maybe midnight, right? And then you'd be up again the next morning back in the newsroom. Because, you know, if you recall, the Boston Marathon bombing was an event which really, sort of the repercussions have continued to go on for much longer. But the actual event was 1 week of people not knowing exactly who the perpetrators were. Then
when
there
the
being
city
a
was
manhunt.
Shut down, yeah.
Exactly. There were tanks, you know, I mean, it was just sort of, it was a really surreal environment. I think as a journalist, it was really, I think I look back on it, it was a challenge, right? Because I didn't know the city. I hardly knew the people. One of the things that I think to me was also sort of, I guess I would almost call it tragic and sort of disheartening at the same time was one of the few people I did know before I'd moved to the city was actually the director of the large Islamic society there. It's a long story, but I'd actually known him as a friend years ago. He's a brilliant guy who had studied in England for grad school, and I had also been in England. And you know, sort of to me was the classic example of the model Muslim anyone would want. You know, played on the soccer team, went to Princeton, and there were some sort of really vicious sort of verbal attacks that I saw about him. And I think that to me was really sort of heartbreaking in the immediate sense of how to just sort of handle that, deal with things. And in many ways also because I knew him to be the type of person who was really trying to improve like interfaith relationships between the mosque and other institutions. He was really in many ways the type of person that you would say if there's somebody you want to hold up to be the sort of model Muslim in America who's really trying to improve relationships between different faith communities, this would be it. And then this horrific event happens. And on a really personal level, it just felt like it took back a lot of the work that he'd been trying to do.
So let's move on to the election. In mid-2015, you switched over to NPR's National Political Reporting Team, just a couple months after Donald Trump announced his candidacy. What was the feeling among reporters when he announced in mid-2015? Talk to me about how you guys discussed that in the newsroom.
Gosh, I'm trying to remember what it was like when he, you know, came down the escalator and announced he was going to run. I don't believe that really anybody took him very seriously. You know, I agreed to the job, I recall, before he had even entered the race. I had agreed to join NPR's political team. And I remember telling my editor that, you know, subsequently there were many things that Donald Trump said and did. And even in that sort of first announcement of a speech, he mentioned his sort of classic line that, you know, about Mexicans that, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but that there are some that are racist and criminals and whatnot, but some of them are good, he said. And that line went on to become sort of, I think, a joke among some people later on, right? But I felt in many ways it was very prescient. It gave us this idea of this is the type of campaign he would run that was very ethnically divisive in many ways.
Well, going off that, in December 2015, following the deadly shooting massacre in San Bernardino, California, then-candidate Trump made a speech and announced he was calling for a ban on Muslims from entering the country. Let's hear from that.
And we put out a statement a little while ago, and these people are going crazy. They won't report it properly. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
This was just one in a long line of inflammatory, some call it offensive, rhetoric from Trump regarding Muslims during the campaign and even after the campaign. What was your reaction to the announcement as a journalist? What was your reaction to the announcement as a Muslim?
So at the end of the campaign cycle, I wrote a pretty candid essay about what covering this election was like, and we taped a podcast about this. And in the podcast, I mentioned that initially, when the email came out announcing the ban, I didn't realize it was newsworthy. And in hindsight, I recognize that sounds kind of ludicrous. You know, either maybe I didn't have the right news judgment or something. But I say this in part because there had been so many vitriolic and inflammatory statements, either directed towards me on Twitter or sort of just said generally in kind of the ethos of this campaign cycle, that when that email came out, because it came out initially, to my knowledge, as an email announcement, I didn't realize it was newsworthy. I keep sort of myself organized by creating different folders in Outlook.
Like
and
a good journalist
I saw
does.
That, right? And I dumped that email into the Donald Trump folder. Mm-hmm. And then subsequently, I saw a colleague of mine kind of like buzzing around the newsroom, going in to talk to the editor, saying, oh my God, this is what's going on. And then I sort of pulled the email out, reread it again, and it still didn't click to me that this was such a newsworthy event, in part because we had seen then candidate Donald Trump, you know, repeatedly use a lot of inflammatory rhetoric about different ethnic and different religious groups. I think Muslims primarily being sort of his target there. And then I had been on the receiving end of things. And I don't know if this entirely makes sense, but at some point you lose the ability to decipher what is newsworthy if you're so accustomed to the inflammatory language.
Just a reminder, you're tuned into Global Journalists. I'm Joshua Kranzberg in for Jason McClure. On today's show, we're taking a break from our regular coverage of underreported international news for an installment of our periodic series of interviews with distinguished journalists. We're joined in studio by one of those distinguished journalists, Asma Khalid. She covered the 2016 presidential campaign for NPR News and is now leading a new team at NPR affiliate WBOR in Boston called Bostonomics, which covers technology and innovation in the city. You know, you wear the hijab, which is part of your representation of your faith. How did wearing it affect your experience on the campaign trail?
So, you know, it is a very visible identifier, right, in terms of being Muslim. And I think in this campaign cycle, we saw that many people had very strong negative feelings about Muslims. And so there were a few times during the campaign that I did not wear a headscarf because the sort of temperature was just really extraordinarily, I think, volatile at certain moments. And you didn't feel like people were going to, A, trust you also. And
how did that make you feel making that concession?
So I guess I'm a sort of practical person, and I don't want to imply that this is the way other Muslims would feel about this. But I'm a believer that, you know, the headscarf in general in Islam is a good thing to do, but not an obligation. And so because of that, and because I would say I'm sort of a practical person in the sense that, you know, you should be safe, you should be wise, it didn't bother me too much. I do think, you know, obviously it would be ideal if we could be in a society in which we could sort of all treat each other with dignity and respect, regardless of what we all look like. And for the most part, I do think people do open up. I mean, that was, I think, maybe the flip side of this experience, which is that, you know, despite how I looked, I, you know, am a Midwesterner. I recognize a lot of the sort of trends that we saw this election cycle. You grew up in Indiana, spent more time in Indiana to date than I have anywhere else. And Indiana is a state where only four counties went for Hillary Clinton. It is a state that overwhelmingly supported Donald Trump. And so I understand and recognize, I think, what a lot of Trump supporters were feeling, particularly on the economic side. And even, to be honest, at times, even on the racially and ethnically divisive side, you know, there are elements of this that you can say that you understand whether or not you agree with, right? I mean, there are people in my life, people that are close to our family, you know, who did support Donald Trump. And to me, there is always this interesting juxtaposition where people support you or maybe like you, you know, mm-hmm. they may like you and your family, but they believe you're not like the other ones. Whether or not that's a good statement, or you could argue a problematic statement, you know, that could be up for debate. But you know, overwhelmingly, once you got to talking to people, once you sort of got down to showing that you, A, wanted to listen, B, you were there to care, C, mm-hmm. you were there to share their story and not to judge, I found that most of the time people were more than willing to chat.
How difficult was it to put your personal beliefs aside when covering politics? Obviously, as journalists, we're taught, we're pushed to be as objective mm-hmm. as possible, and that's always the goal. But there has to be a point when, you know, maybe not the first comment, but the 8th, the 9th, the 20th, the 50th comment has to get to you or had to get to anyone in that experience.
So, I mean, there were, I think, just questions about faith and the idea of Muslims being a part of American society that seemed up for debate in this election cycle. And that, I think, is that was a challenge for me, no doubt. I mean, I feel that on a lot of issues, I really actually don't have strong opinions, for good or for bad. And I think that that has allowed me over the years as a journalist to really sort of open myself up to, you know, people that I interview and hear what they're saying, because I don't feel particularly passionate about a whole host of public policy issues. I'm just very curious about why people feel a certain way. This election cycle, though, the idea of being Muslim seemed up for debate. And in my mind, that's never been a question that's up for debate, right? Like, it's a non-debatable issue, it's not gun control. Beyond that too, you know, I grew up in the U.S. I'm from the U.S. My mother's from the U.S. My grandparents are from the U.S. It's sort of this idea of this is an unresolved, this is sort of a non-debatable issue. And so I think for many voters this election cycle, this felt like something we should be debating, my very existence in this country. And I do think that's a challenge. There was a gentleman I met at a Donald Trump volunteer training session in Florida. And we got to talking, and he wanted to, you know, share a whole host of opinions with me. And we had a good interview. And then at the end, I was about to leave. And he said, wait, there's one more thing I want to share with you. I want to tell you about. He's like, I want to tell you why I think the Muslim ban is really good for Muslims. And so he went on to explain his theory in a nutshell is that if there were to be another violent terrorist attack committed by Muslims, that the general American population would just sort of revolt, and we would see something akin to, say, World War II concentration camps. And he said, I want to protect the good ones, essentially people like me, he believed were good. And the only way he could see to do that, to sort of prevent the mass revolt of the American public if there is this other terrorist attack, is to protect the ones that are already in the U.S., is by preventing additional Muslims to come into the country. And he went on to explain that, you know, he had read some stuff in the Quran and believed that good, holy Muslims believed in. So he said that there are some Muslims, he called them the true believers, who believe that that killing is a part of the faith. I had studied Islamic theology. I've actually got a master's in Islamic studies from the University of Cambridge when I was in England, and strongly disbelieve, you know, that assessment of my religion. But in that moment, I didn't say anything, right? And I think that that's what sort of gnaws at you is, as a journalist, you want people to share their thoughts and their opinions with you, but it didn't feel appropriate to really get into a theological argument about whether or not your existence in this country is valid. And moreover, you know, whether or not you actually believe your religion dictates something that somebody else is telling you that your religion is.
Do you feel, and I'm not saying this was the case, but do you feel like you sort of left something on the table by not doing that? Does that make sense? Like, you not getting into that argument, obviously you might have gotten into that argument 30 times over the course of the campaign, but not getting into that argument maybe, you know, I don't want to say, I don't think this, like, you, that you let that you let people down, or that you let people in your faith down by not standing up to that sort of those sort of comments.
So my attitude on this in general is, you know, we are years after 9/11, and there are many, many Muslims who've lived in this country for a number of years. And at this point, if people still feel like the Muslim next door is a violent possible threat, I don't really think that there's much I can say or do to convince them otherwise. You know, I remember being at a Marco Rubio rally in New Hampshire, and I was packing up my radio gear, and a gentleman came over to me and he said, you know, excuse me, ma'am, can I ask you a question? I said, okay. And he said, you know, why do your people believe in female genital mutilation? And my jaw nearly dropped, and I was like, I don't know what you're referring to. Like, I do not participate in such activity, nor does any Muslim I know in America. My father is a physician, you know, and it was just sort of this bizarre interaction where I said, well, I don't know. You know, maybe you should ask somebody who does, but this is not something that plurality of the Muslims, it's not something any Muslim I know in America participates in. So then he shifted gears and he asked me about Iran and the Ayatollah. And I said, again, you know, I don't know what you're referring to. And I think that there's this interesting juxtaposition where, you know, anytime I'd meet a voter, they would like for me to answer all their questions about Islam that they've ever had that are global, right? And if you were to posit that on like the average, you know, white Christian, you may to ask them to answer every question about global white people or global Christian people. I mean, you say that out loud and you realize sort of the hilarity of it.
Exactly.
But I tried at times to answer questions. I think oftentimes my answers were, well, I don't know. You know, I'm from Indiana. My dad's a doctor, so he doesn't believe in this, and nor have anyone I've ever met believe in this. And maybe just the sheer fact that I didn't fit the vision that they thought of as a Muslim, I do think was sort of a curiosity for people. There was this one quick story I'd like to share with you is that I was in Colorado, and there's a woman I met at a Republican county dinner. And I was interviewing her, and that after the interview, she came back and she asked me, she wanted to give me her phone number. And then she asked me if I had free time between interviews that she'd like to invite me over for tea and cookies. And she wanted me to meet some of her family. And so invitations like this had happened before, you know, and this was what I thought was sort of interesting is I would get invitations often, you know, from some Trump supporters to come over for lunch or spend the weekend on their boat. And I had never taken anyone up on those offers, but this time I did. I had some time between the interview. I think I was just honestly exhausted, and I was like, all right, you know, why not? And so I went over. We didn't record the conversation. It was just literally a casual interaction where I had, you know, some tea and some cookies at her house, and she packed me up some cookies for the road. And she had all sorts of questions. You know, she asked me about my childhood in Indiana. She had grown up in neighboring Kentucky.
Okay.
She asked me about my work as a journalist, and you know, ultimately, I can surmise here, right? There were some things that were left unsaid, but I reckon I was probably the first Muslim she'd ever had in her house. And to some degree, I just didn't fit the vision of what she had had in her mind. So maybe it is sort of like a low-level diplomacy, you could argue. But sometimes, you know, I guess I feel like that's okay. You know, Muslims are, what, 1% of the American population. I can understand if you haven't met a lot before. I guess I would just ask that if you haven't asked, you know, haven't met somebody before, the simple decency is to not presume that you know all about them.
Of course. Just a reminder that this is Global Journalist. I'm Joshua Kranzberg in for Jason McClure. On this special edition of the program, we're talking to Asma Khalid, who covered the 2016 presidential campaign for NPR News and is now business and technology reporter in Boston. If you want more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the video cast of this program on YouTube, or download our podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to shift a little bit kind of off the election to your focus of the election was demographics. Mm-hmm. They were obviously a huge focal point. With the election and with tech and social media companies, how big of a role do you think Facebook, Twitter, Google, all of those tech companies played in the 2016 election?
Gosh, I think those are all questions that many journalists and many people on the Hill, and you could argue many tech leaders themselves, are trying to figure out at this point. I think that undoubtedly you could make the case that social media played a role in our elections. You could also make the argument that social media played a role in the 2012 election cycle as well. I just think this time around it played a different type of role. And so what I guess I'm trying to explain is that, you know, by and large, when you talk to people, many voters would talk about how often they would see something on Facebook or see something on Twitter. Facebook is usually more common for people. And you know, that allowed people to essentially just get their news from a curated list of friends. You would often have advertisements there also that are directed towards you. And so some of the questions that have come up after the election are, you know, where these advertisements were coming from and what they looked like, right? If there are advertisements that show up on television, we all collectively know what they look like. Those advertisements, be they, you know, from the Trump campaign or the Clinton campaign, were sort of, they were shared with the general public. There were targeted ads directed at voters of a specific demographic that many of us have never seen and may never, you know, see at all. And I think that that does raise questions about funding and campaign finance and where essentially these funds are coming from and who they're targeting.
You're talking about where people get their news. One source that's getting increasingly popular is podcasts. You're a podcast junkie. why do you think people getting their news from podcasts is becoming more and more popular. Why do you think that is?
So a part of it, you could make the case, is just because we're all so attached to our phones. See, I got mine here. it's just a platform that we all are using obsessively, right? And so podcasting allows you to just plug a set of headphones in and you could listen to whatever you want on there. The other reason is I do think many of us are going to news sources that we want mm-hmm. versus news that's already curated for us. Mm. This latter fact makes me a little nervous, despite the fact that I'm really excited about podcasting. And it makes me nervous because I can't tell you the amount of times I've just turned on my radio. You know, I was listening actually to BBC NewsHour earlier today, which I love. It's actually the very first place I got a start in radio when I was in the UK. And they do amazing international news. And I heard stories that I wouldn't have expected and didn't know much about, you know? And there's that spontaneity you get when you sort of are informed about something you didn't even know you might be interested in. Mm. And so now with podcasting, I generally go to what I want. You know, I'm sort of interested in business financial news. I'll tune into Planet Money, which I love. It's an NPR podcast. And, you
good
know,
plug,
I get it.
Good
yeah, good
plug.
And, you know, and I can see what I want. I can listen to what I want. You know, there's another podcast, The Daily, that The New York Times does, which I'm a big fan of. And, it's a narrated daily, or should I say it's somewhat non-narrative, but it has this narrative element to it, and it's a daily news podcast. And, you know, there is some element of them still choosing the topic I'm going to listen to today, and I like that.
But it's open-ended.
But it's open-ended, mm-hmm. right? And so I would say that I think that the trends are shifting more and more towards podcast consumption as opposed to just pure listening to the radio over the old school radio. And a part of that is, look, not as many people are necessarily driving and in their cars. And if you're on a subway or you're walking or you're young and you don't listen to the radio for news, you're going to end up just listening to a podcast.
About a minute left. Let's go on to your latest venture, Bostonomics.
Sure.
What is it all about and what are you going to be doing there?
Yes. So I'm leading a biz tech team. Our focus is to look at innovation, and some of the major themes I'm interested in sprang out from some of my campaign coverage, and those are robotics, automation, and AI. I'm just really interested in how those forces are affecting the future of work, how work is looking really different than how it used to, and essentially what that could mean potentially for job displacement. Boston, I think, is a huge, what I would call, tech exporter, so some of the effects of work aren't always felt around Boston, but it's a city that is innovating and creating a lot of this. And what I'd like to do is be able to find how some of these things affect other communities.
So will we see you on the trail for 2020? Someone might announce tomorrow. They're already talking about the 2020 field.
Oh,
so.
Gosh. I don't know. I haven't really made up my mind about that yet.
Well, that's all for this edition of Global Journalists, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many, many, many thanks to Asma Khalid of WBOR Boston for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Ellen Beaton, Edom Kasaye, and Raina Sims. Lauren Wortman is our supervising producer, and Elisa Blyle is our visual editor. Travis McMillan of Reynolds Journalism Institute is our director. For all of us here at Global Journalists, I'm Joshua Kranzberg in for Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.